The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Welcome to IMC. So, this morning I'd like to talk about sincerity and how maybe it relates to Buddhist practice. And couple of introductions to the topic. One is that a story that I've told before. There's a Zen student who was a student of Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center. And this student asked the Zen teacher that if he practiced Zen, would he get enlightened? And the Zen teacher said, if your practice is sincere, it's just about as good. And I was very inspired by this. It's almost as good. So maybe it's good enough. Good enough is good enough. So to practice sincerely. And the other is a little bit about these terrorist attacks in Paris. You know, it's a big deal for our global community that this happened. And, you know, and then for Europe, you know, on top of this huge immigrant refugee wave that came in, that's really going to change the face of Europe and the globe in a big way. Not necessarily bad, but certainly going to change it. And how we negotiate this and how we find our way through this, it's going to have a lot to do with what happens probably for the next century. And one of the important questions for any of us is, what kind of world do we want to live in? And we could have all kinds of ideas of what kind of world we want to live in, as if the world is outside of us. And one of the understandings in Buddhism is that there is a kind of a teaching in Buddhism, the Buddha, that the world is here in you, that you are the world. The world begins and ends with you. And there's a whole teachings around that, but in a sense, the world begins with you. The beginning of time begins with you when you wake up in the morning or when you open your eyes from blinking it. That there's always something, it's always starting fresh, anew. And that Buddha's teachings on karma are not meant to explain why things have happened, but rather are a teaching that encourages us that after we blink, how we respond, how we step forward, how we speak, what we do, is consequential. And so the world begins for us in the moment with our response to the world, how we take the next step, what we do. And so the question of what kind of world do we want to live in has a lot to do with how do we respond, how do we take the next step, how do we create a world for ourselves in the next step that we make. So the beginning of, if there is a beginning, technically there's no beginning to the Buddhist scriptures, but if one of the passages that most qualifies as the beginning of Buddhist scriptures, like the Buddhist Bible or something, is the first verse of the Dhammapada. And it goes, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. And so here, if this is the beginning, it all begins in our mind. Our experience, what goes on with us, is somehow has its genesis in our mind, in our interpretations, our reactions, our ideas, our impulses, our intentions, that's where it all kind of begins for us. We blink and it becomes a new world we step into. And this radical kind of impermanence of Buddhism emphasizes that what you do after you blink, and you probably blink regularly, right? Many times a minute, that it's a new world. And how do you meet that? As opposed to, you know, you blink and you open your eyes and it's back to the same old world, and you have your opinions and ideas, and it's oppressive or difficult or all this stuff. It's a fresh world every time we start. And so how do we come forward? What do we bring to that? And then almost right after this, there's a verse, very famous verse. Well, actually, I'll just read you what follows these two verses. It's kind of like the examples, I guess. He abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those carrying on like this, hatred does not end. She abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those not carrying on like this, hatred ends. So the example of someone who kind of stuck in a certain view, they blink, and after they open their eyes, they're still having the same old ideas of being the victim. You did it to me. You did terrible things to me. You know, I've been abused. You've defeated me. And so to be stuck in those kinds of ideas is a source of hatred and fear and things. But if you don't have these kinds of fixed views, then hatred ends. And it goes on and says, hatred never ends through hatred, but by non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. Hatred never ends through hatred. And some people translate the next line as, by love alone does it end. And so the idea of how do we blink and open our eyes? Do we meet the world that we encounter with hate? Or do we meet it with love or with non-hatred? How do we meet it? How do we are? And so Buddhist spirituality, Buddhist practice has a lot to do with kind of appreciating that we start here with ourselves in the mind, in our hearts, and we care for that. We tend to it. And from that, then we can respond to the world. But if we don't tend to this here, then we don't respond so well. Some people complain with teachings like this, that we start with ourselves, because it's selfish. You know, it's like self-absorbed. You can focus on yourself. There's a lot of important things to do in the world. You should go out there and take care of things, and spend some time meditating when you could be doing things. And I think it's as simple as, like if someone, you know, the archetype of a doctor, doctors, you know, helping a lot of people heal and get well, and it's a great thing to do, right? But I think most doctors continue probably very ineffective as a doctor if they didn't regularly shower. Wash their hair and shower and take care of basic hygiene, brush their teeth. And usually you do that alone. It's a private thing, you know, to take a shower and brush your teeth. And then you come back, and then you come out to do work, and you're, you know, that's, you know, your hygiene. You're ready to care for people and meet people in a way that they don't cringe or run away or put, you know, clothespins over their nose as they, you know, you go to your doctor. So, you know, so we take care of ourselves so that we can, in fact, take care of the world better. This morning I was, I didn't sit when I first got up, but I sat and kind of read a little bit of news and had some good drink. And I was sitting in a chair in my living room, and I was, and what went through my mind was something like, you know, well, I don't really need to sit. I'm going to sit here when I get to IMC, and you know, and you know, I'm fine just sitting here. I'm in good shape, something like that. And so then I went to sit, and as soon as I sat down and took this posture like this, I realized that I had fooled myself. That you know, that I was fine. It's true, I was kind of fine conventionally, but as soon as I sat there, I could feel that my breath was a little bit held, and my shoulders were a little bit held up, a little bit, and that by sitting down this way, then I really got in touch with a deeper level of what was going on for me. It wasn't dramatic what was going on, but I wasn't as fine as I thought I was, and. And so the idea of sitting here and then taking the shower, taking the mind shower, that meditation is letting things settle and the breathing come back to be a more harmonious way, and the body kind of relax a little bit. And I felt, you know, pretty good after that. And so, so the idea of taking care of ourselves and then how we come forward and how we meet the world is how we choose the world that we're going to live in. And so when there are these kinds of terrorist attacks that we all kind of experience, and some of us feel closer to another, some of you maybe had family in Paris and friends or something. For me, when I saw the location where it happened, some of the locations, that last year I was with my 16-year-old son, and we stayed in a little hotel about two blocks away from where a couple of the shootings happened on the same road. And it's kind of like, that was kind of felt close. A year later, down the street, could happen to any of us anywhere. So what kind of world do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a world where we are kind of snowed under, I said the expression, snowed under by occurrences of the what happens in the world, and succumb to anger and hate and fear and close down? Or is are these the times that we've been, for those of us who do spiritual practice, the practice has been preparing us for these times. And you know, someday it might happen here, something like this. And so we're preparing ourselves for when it happens. We're preparing ourselves when the San Andreas Fault goes. We're preparing ourselves when there's a shooting, you know, in our neighborhood, or when there's some tragedy to you. We're preparing us for those, so that we can, when we blink, meet the world fresh, meet it, and kind of, and have come forward with our, with creating the world we want, with creating the immediacy of here. Let's meet the world with love. Let's meet the world with care and empathy, and rather than closing down. So part of this is the topic for today, which is sincerity. I think that it's a worthwhile topic or quality of mind, quality of heart, to consider meditation practice or Buddhist practice in light of. And I just like the story of Suzuki Roshi saying, your practice is just as good or almost as good if it's sincere. I think it's a to really feel the sincerity of your practice as a kind of measure of your practice, it's much wiser than it is to measure yourself by what state of concentration you're in. If you attain the, you know, the third, fourth, 15th jhana yet, you know, it's a deep level of absorption, if you have one-pointed concentration, are you able to stay with, you know, 100 breaths in a row, and, you know, have you gotten the, you know, some deep state of peace and equanimity and some state, some experience. But rather than measuring your practice that way, to measure it by, is it sincere? Are we sincere when we do it? So I want to talk about some of the qualities that I think come along with sincerity. And the first one is honesty. And I think of mindfulness practice as a practice of honesty. In fact, I'd be very content to, you know, drop the word mindfulness and say we're practicing honesty, and we're practicing, and we sit in a posture and close our eyes that conventionally is called a meditation posture, but it's an honesty posture where we kind of can really check in and find out what's going on here, just like I did this morning, that I had fooled myself a little bit, and I sat down to be with myself, and then only then did I discover some of the deeper currents of what was going on for me. And so to sit, to be honest. And honesty is not so much about attainment of something, but about waking up to what is here for us right now. And so if you're really honest about yourself, what's happening, if you're truthful about it, sitting in the moment, well, what would you notice? What would you see? What would you discover? Sometimes if we're focusing on getting concentrated or getting some place in meditation, it becomes a bypass because we're looking beyond ourselves. And by doing that, we have blinders on, and we're not really taking the time to be truthful. What's happening here? What's really true for me right now, in my feelings, in my emotions, my thoughts, in my body, in my heart? What is going on here? And then to keep it up, you blink. And I guess when you meditate, you don't blink so often. But, you blink, you take a moment, and then how do you respond to that? How do you meet, when you're truthful, what's here? How do you meet that? And do you meet that? What world do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a world where you criticize yourself for what you discover and are afraid of what you discover when you're truthful? Or do you live in a world where you can meet it with generosity, with kindness, with openness, with some useful way? So to practice honesty, and and in terms of Buddhist practice, we always want to be honest about ourselves, honest to ourselves. Whether we're honest in the world outside to people when we speak, I mean that's a little bit. Generally, yes, it's a good idea. But as they say in philosophy classes, when they talk about honesty, they say, if it's an hour before the bride's getting married, and she asks you what you think of her wedding dress, and you think it just got awful, and you practice radical honesty and truthfulness, and tell her how it is, that's pretty painful. That could mess someone up for a lifetime, right? You can either get, on their way to their wedding and feeling horrible. And so you figure out something else to say. You say, the honest, you say, that color of that dress goes so well with the color of the dress of the other bride. Two women getting married, right? So the question of, are we always honest in the world around us is, something we have to be careful with, how we do that. But we're always supposed to be honest. In this practice, we're always supposed to be honest to ourselves. And that's part of the trick and the art of this practice here. And it's represented symbolically in Buddhism, or kind of mythically, in the story of the Buddha, where there's this myth that Buddha had many lifetimes before he became the Buddha. And in those myths, it said that in many of those lifetimes, he did unethical things because, he was not enlightened yet. And so there's stories about him doing all kinds of things which were unethical, breaking the precepts. But there was one of the precepts that he never broke. In all these many countless lifetimes preparing to be a Buddha, he never lied. And so there's tremendous importance on not lying, of being honest. So at least to yourself, we want to be honest to ourselves. And so how do we create self-honesty? I know that meditating is one of those ways. Sit down and really be present and tune in to what's going on, how what's feeling. A great place to check in, kind of a truth teller, is to go on a meditation retreat. A longer retreat, not just meditating for half an hour at home, but if you can go on an overnight residential retreat, there's something about the stillness and the silence and then kind of the way we step away from our ordinary life, just being there, that reveals things about ourselves that I call it a great truth-telling, to show up there and be there. Occasionally I meet people who say that, they've done a lot of retreats in the past and they haven't done retreats for a number of years and they don't really feel a need for it because they feel pretty, okay in their lives and things are okay. And I say, well, if this practice is important for you, if you haven't gone for a retreat for a few years, you should probably go on one just to make sure that you're really... And because not a few people who do this then go and retreat and they say, oh, I didn't realize how much I wasn't attending to and how much was going on for me, just like I did this morning with my little sitting. So sincerity has a lot to do with being honest. The second thing that I think of sincerity is I think of integrity. And integrity can be related to ethics, to being ethical, but I like the word integrity because of how it relates to being integral, being whole. And so we want to be whole, we want to be complete. And that's closely connected to being honest. If we're honest with ourselves, then we're not being separate from parts of ourselves. We're not denying or avoiding parts of ourselves. And so the idea of becoming whole, being whole. And so when we sit down to meditate, in an honest way to check in truthfully what's happening here, what would it mean to be whole, to sit here and become whole? Again, it does not mean, you know, necessarily getting into some deep state of concentration. It doesn't mean necessarily to have some profound state of equanimity or peace or bliss. To be whole means that everything that you are is included, nothing left out. And so part of you might be angry, you might be sad, you might be concerned about all kinds of things in the world. And how do you include it all so you become whole? If you don't want to be honest about something, I'm not going to look at that, I'm not going to admit that. How do you become whole with that means to really see that clearly, be honest about that, and hold that in this picture. Part of what mindfulness is, meditation is, can be, is to open up the field of awareness that's wide enough that all of who you are can be included within it. So there's no division within ourselves. We're not at war with any part of ourselves. We're not offering preferential treatment to some part of ourselves, but that we open up and we allow ourselves, you know, to be whole. So we sit and meditate. How do I include all of who I am right now? What would it be like now? So it's closely related to the topic of being honest, but it's the principle of being whole. And the connection with ethics and that kind of wholeness or integrity is that I think that more often than not, people do unethical things when they're separated from themselves, when they're not really completely connected to all of who they are. We're more likely to hurt other people or not have empathy for other people's situations, and therefore do unethical things when we're not really connected to all of who we are. So to sit down and meditate and say, how can I be complete now? What do I have to include? What do I have to include in my awareness? What do I have to accept in my awareness right now so that all of me is included? The third aspect of its sincerity, I associate with how we act, what we do. And I like the expression to act wholeheartedly. And that's a big part of my training in Zen, was to learn to do what I did wholeheartedly. It didn't necessarily mean to do things fast, though that was in the Zen monasteries in Japan. Sometimes we had to run between everywhere we went. You know, most of the monks were 21. And it was a little bit like boot camp at some of these Zen monasteries in Japan. And so it was a little bit over the top. All the bell would ring and we all run. You know, sometimes in the meditation hall, we would have one-on-one meetings with a teacher, very short little meetings. You present your koan, this question you have, and your answer. So you can go through it very fast because most of the answers are wrong. So the teacher would just ring the bell and you had to leave. The first time this happened, when they rang the bell, with people sitting and meditating in the meditation hall, and it was time to go to line up and have these interviews with the teacher, I didn't know how it worked. I didn't see it coming even. It was new in the monastery. And so there were probably about 25, 30 monks in the monastery, all sitting in the meditation hall. We were being very still, very upright, very pristine. Imagine a Japanese kind of silent, Japanese, you know, rock garden, you know, feeling. It was a beautiful, beautiful, pristine monastery and very still. And then there was a bell, bing. And suddenly there was an explosion of monks. Robes and zafus and kept their sandals in the meditation hall, and they were flying up in the air and they were jostling positions, running out the door, trying to get to the abbot first. So that was pretty wholehearted. But I think a little bit too much. And wholehearted doesn't have to be fast and you know, racing and competitive interviews with the teacher. But wholeheartedly, I think of is to give yourself completely over to what you're doing. If you're going to do something and you want to do it sincerely, do it honestly, do it whole heart, do it with integrity, and bring yourself fully into doing it. So you really want to do it, like your heart is in what you're doing. So it's wholehearted. You don't do things sincerely if your heart is not in it. And our lives are so precious and so important that if we don't do things wholeheartedly, if we don't have our heart in what we do, we're really shortchanging ourselves dramatically. And of course, there are things many times we don't want to do. We have to do. And then the task is to figure out how to do it wholeheartedly. What do you have to do? What do you have to muster? What do you have to understand so you can give yourself fully into doing this wholeheartedly? And if you can't find a way, maybe you shouldn't do it. Maybe there are things you do in your life that you don't really bring your whole heart to. It's not a heartfelt feeling. It's not something you really care about enough to really want to bring all of yourself to it. And then is that really what you want to do, how you want to spend your life? So to be wholehearted in what you do, not to be held back, not to be afraid, not to be inhibited. And so this idea that our world starts fresh every time we blink. And so when you open your eyes, how are you going to meet what's there? Are you going to meet it honestly? Are you going to meet it completely? Let all of yourself be there for that experience? Are you going to be there and respond in a wholehearted way? And the last thing I'll say about wholeheartedly and sincere and doing things, being sincere in life. You have to hear this just the right way to assume that maybe at first you don't understand what I'm going to say, and then be willing to kind of work it to see how it really comes alive for you. And that is that one of the, I think, most profound attitudes you can bring to life is to say yes to what comes. Now, sometimes that yes has to take the form of no. but that the disposition is to say yes, this too, and to, you know, yes. So we're kind of open and present for what's here. So we sit down to meditate and yes, this too. Yes, I'm feeling really tense when I sit down to meditate. Yes, so it's like this, and I'll open, I'll be complete, I'll be honest about this, and I'll be wholehearted in meditating as a tense person. That's what it is. I'll just be here as opposed to, I'm tense, and I'm probably the only tense person in IMC this morning, and you know, probably a Buddhist failure, and I shouldn't be here, and there's one more proof how often I'm wrong, and it doesn't make any sense to meditate when you're tense, and I'm here, so I might as well occasionally I'll check in with my breath and touch in, but I think that fantasizing about what to have for lunch is more interesting. So, you know, there's the kind of not to hold. So to be honest of what's happening, where you're at, to be able to be inclusive, to include everything in a generous way of who you are and make space for it all, and then to be wholehearted in your engagement. And all of that supported by a yes to life as opposed to a no. So those are my thoughts today. And now it's your turn. We have a few minutes, 10 minutes or so. If you'd like to comment on that or ask questions of this or anything else about practice, you're welcome to.
Okay. So what came up for me when you spoke about the things in Paris was how often it has to become personal before we pay attention to something.
Yeah.
Because there was a very serious bombing in Lebanon also, very recently.
Yes. For us in California, people I know, and me even, yeah. It didn't affect me as deeply.
So the Paris thing even... wasn't terribly personal till I found out my sister was there with her husband. and I'm relieved that they're very well. They weren't harmed. But I think I would like to be able to care more about things that aren't personal to me. I think it would be good for me to care without it having to be that close.
That's beautiful. Beautiful what you say. I appreciate it a lot. And yeah, so this, I know for me that the bombing in Lebanon the last week, certainly didn't affect me as deeply as what happened in Paris. However, there was a bombing in Lebanon in Beirut that had a big impact on me, and part of the reason I'm here today is because of it. Is that in about 1981 or 82, I was at the monastery and I opened in Time or Newsweek magazine, and there was a photographs of bombing of refugee camps in Beirut, in Lebanon, outside Beirut, I guess. And I had been sitting in the monastery on retreat for months. I hadn't seen much news, and very still, very open. And I opened this magazine and saw these pictures of the bombing. And that felt like it, you know, I grew up on the edge of the Mediterranean, so you know, it was just down the coast. And a little bit, and it felt like it had a big impact on me, and it felt so important to be a witness to this. I felt I should go to Lebanon, just be a witness. We need to witness these things and take them in. And that had such a big impact on me. It was one of the things that then moved me to decide to become a Buddhist monk, but in order to support other people through Buddhism. And that led me eventually to become a Buddhist teacher and ended up being here. So bombings in Lebanon, you know, if we take it in and are influenced by it, it can have a big impact. But it's this thing about, you know, what affects us. And I don't know, is this a part, you know, how much we can take in the world around us? And is it okay to feel more deeply about things that are close than things that are far away? If we have a dog and someone in my family yells and curses at the dog, it's pretty painful. If my neighbor yells and curses at his dog, you know, it's pretty painful, but it's a little bit further away. If someone in the next block yells and curses their dog, you know, if I even hear about it, it's like, you know, that's too bad, that's sad. If someone in the next state yells and curses at their dog, if I hear about someone cursing their dog and yelling at a dog, you know, in halfway around the world, you know, it's not going to impact me as much. If I curse and yell at my dog, I hope that makes a big impression on me, and you know, sit down to meditate afterwards, I'm just reverberating and feel that's bad. So there's something about the concentric circles of where we are that maybe there's some way in which there are different distances for different ways that things affect us in different ways. As the quote I read about, you know, it all proceeds from your mind. For me, it's meaningful that you want to start with the most concentric circles you have, which is yourself, the closest in place, and care for that. Clean that up, take care of that well. And then you want to, I think one of the principles of Buddhism, and this is maybe what Stephanie is motivated to do, is to slowly start to expand your love and care. So it becomes more and more, spreads out to include more and more people in it. So first yourself, and it's so good to start with yourself, and then your family, and then your friends, and your neighbors, and then your community. And then you keep expanding it out and out so that eventually everyone's included. And we don't live in a society of divisions, and we can go on and include the whole world.
Yeah, speaking of the wholeheartedness that you mentioned, a lot of times at work and even in life, you don't want to do...
Yeah, it is on, but he's talking softly, so maybe...
Yeah. So a lot of times at work and in life, probably would not enjoy doing a particular thing.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned probably find ways to do it wholeheartedly.
Yes.
So could you please exemplify with an example or something? How can you find ways to do a thing wholeheartedly when you, in fact, didn't enjoy or wouldn't enjoy?
Yeah, it's a great question. So how is it that we can do things wholeheartedly when we don't want to do them? We dislike doing them, especially mentioned about being at work. Since it was so formative when I was young to be in a Zen monastery, where there's a lot of work, physical work to do rather than maybe computer work, I learned a lot about this by being fully physically in the activity that I did. And it's represented by how, when I was in Japan, I was sometimes, my job was to bring the white rice, for supper to the dining room table. And I would just pick up the pot by its handle, one handle, and just carry it. You know, it was not a heavy pot, just carry it in one hand. And whenever I did that, I got reprimanded by the other monks. Because, partly because rice is like, you know, apple pie, and for some people in America, it's like represents Japan. And so you had to hold it with respect, hold it with two hands. In a Zen monastery, if you drink a cup, you don't just pick it up casually, you know, and like, you know, but you actually would go lean forward and you'd pick it up with both hands. And so you physically, you bring all of yourself to it, as opposed to just part of yourself. And that I learned a lot about being wholehearted from that physical act in the Zen monastery. When you do something, you really be there with your full body and everything, because I was not very embodied when I was younger, and I would do things kind of partially, and if I didn't like to do them, I would just kind of like, you know, just part of my body would kind of be in it. And so that taught me a lot of what it felt like internally to do things wholeheartedly and to be fully present for something. And one of the things I learned through that and through meditation was not how to... one of the things that helped me to learn how to be wholehearted was I learned how not to be held back, how not to hold myself back, how not to have ideas, I don't like this, and then live in those ideas. I don't like this, I shouldn't be doing it, it's not fair, other people should do it. So in the monastery in Japan, the monks were sent out to mow the lawn. My lawn wasn't that big, maybe as big as this room or something, I don't remember how big it was. And there were, you know, 20, 30 of us sent out to mow the lawn, right? And the reason why we needed so many was we were all given scissors. We're all out there, you know. And, you know, cutting. And, you know, and so that I thought that was ridiculous. You know, and one person could do it really quickly with a little, even, push mower. And I was sitting there, this is ridiculous, and how this like these people, they don't know, you know, they should join the modern world and get a little push mower, and I could have been burning up with this, and what a waste of my time. I came to Japan to study Zen, and how are you going to discover Zen, you know, cut it, you know, the scissors and a lawn. But what I learned was how these kinds of attitudes is a way of holding myself back. And to learn how to let go of the attitudes that are holding myself back. And the more we can see those attitudes that we have that keep us from giving ourselves to the activity, then we can learn to let go of them. And so you might look at your attitudes and see if there's some attitude that keeps you from really being there. Maybe one more. We have time for one more. Especially if I can offer a short answer.
At the end, you mentioned that sometimes the yes has to come in the form of a no. I know for at least me personally in the practice, I've been kind of struggling with when do you say yes and accept something, or when do you recognize that it's healthier to kind of step away. So could you kind of expand on that?
Well, I don't I think the steps that I kind of cover today maybe is one way to find that, is first by being really honest with yourself and what's going on, and being whole, have this integrity whole, include all of yourself in the picture. And those two things might give you better information about what you need to do. And then if you can, sometimes if you can talk to other people about that, if you're just really honest with other people, like if you have to say no to someone, you know, if you kind of explain to people why, you know, what's going on with you. Someone asks you if they want to go out for dinner or for lunch or something with you, and but you know, you're tired and you're kind of like just exhausted, and one more conversation with people is just too much. So you can just say no, and then the person, you know, doesn't know why, and it just kind of feels like a little friction. Or you can say, well, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to have to say no, but here's why. And you're kind of like this, you're honest, you're complete, you're here, and so they know. And it's a lot better. So I think the more you can know yourself, and the more you understand what's motivating you and the impact it has on you, and the easier it is to make those kinds of decisions. The short answer. So great. So if this word sincerity has any meaning for some of you, all of you, then you might want to see what it, if you kind of drop it into your meditation practice or in your mindfulness practice as you go about your life or in your life in general, and see kind of just if you kind of carry that concept around and practice sincerity more than mindfulness, sincerity more than meditation. What happens when that becomes the leavening of your practice. Thank you.